is number 07-2032, the United States against York. Mr. Keenan.
May it please the Court, Brian Keenan on behalf of Appellant Darvell York. Mr. York appeals his conviction for distributing cocaine base. His conviction was a result of an encounter with a confidential informant named Tracy Mitchell. However, at trial, Mr. Mitchell, the informant, never testified. Mr. York was convicted without any eyewitnesses who saw drugs or money change hands. He was convicted without being arrested after this encounter with Mitchell and without the money ever being recovered. Instead, the government relied on ambiguous audio tapes of the encounter between York and Mitchell. On top of that, they used two law enforcement personnel who served as expert witnesses to interpret those tapes so that they evidenced a drug deal taking place. These experts interpreted the words of what the non-testifying informant meant. This expert testimony was improper for three reasons. First, the government used Agent Brown as both a primary fact witness in the case and as an expert at the same time, in contravention of cases of this court. Second, both experts went well beyond the proper bounds of what an expert is supposed to testify to, began interpreting non-ambiguous and non-code words and phrases. And second, both experts violated Mr. York's right to confront the witnesses against him when they began explaining what the non-testifying informant meant on the tapes. First, on the dual role issue, this court's made clear that it has concerns about law enforcement agents who serve both as a fact witness and as an expert witness in the same case. This dual role can lead to confusion amongst the jury about which hat the officer is wearing when he's testifying, whether he's testifying as an expert, as a fact witness. The problem with this is that the jury may unduly credit both the fact testimony because the officer is simultaneously serving as an expert, but then also may unduly credit the expert testimony because they think that the officer who's had personal involvement with the case may have some sort of special knowledge that isn't even before the jury, some inside information gained from the case, which is informing the expert opinion. The government's very questioning of Agent Brown highlights this these problems. The questioning was blatantly muddling the difference between the expert and fact roles. On short appendix page 22, they ask him some fact questions. What did you do after your first meeting with Mitchell? And the agent explains that, moving on to 23, that I asked him to go back and wait for Mr. York to deliver the quantity of drugs that he had just ordered. But then, immediately, the government moves into expert territory, saying, in line 10, based on your experience of crack cocaine investigations, and this investigation in particular, what was your understanding of the term 6, 55, and 55 in the tape as you heard it? This question blatantly asks him to use both his expert and factual hats at the same time. The judge, over objection, allows him to answer, and Mr. Brown says that 6 means $6,000, that 5 means $500, and 55 means $5,500. Any juror listening to this exchange would think that Brown was using both of his roles when answering these questions, that he was using both his knowledge gained from the investigation. The prosecution had established Mr. Brown's interactions with the informant Mitchell, that he had talked with Mitchell, that he had watched Mitchell throughout this whole time. And they would also have thought he was using his expert hat. They clearly asked him about all his cocaine investigations. I think the government sort of leaps back and forth between fact, expert, which is quite in contrast to the procedures that were upheld by this court just recently in United States versus Upton. In that case, the government used a witness as both a fact witness and an expert, but the court was able to take precautionary measures to limit the prejudicial impact. The court divided the witness's testimony into two halves. The first half testified as a fact witness. Then the court took a break so that it would be very clear to the jury that that was fact testimony. And they move on, and after the break, testified as an expert. So it's very clear what role he was playing. In addition, the court gave a cautionary instruction so that a jury wouldn't be confused about the dual role. In this case, none of those procedures were taken, in part because the government never disclosed that Agent Brown was going to be testifying as a witness, as an expert witness, so the court was not aware that this type of problem was there.
I want to ask you about that, Mr. Keenan. This was the second go-around for this trial, wasn't it? Didn't the first trial end a hung verdict?
It was. So it was the second trial. The first trial ended in a hung jury.
So was the nature of Mr. Brown's testimony different in the first go-around, so that he gave no expert opinion or no interpretation?
The testimony was roughly the same, where he did offer some expert interpretations. We take the position that the government shouldn't be rewarded for making the same mistake twice and violating the defendant's right twice, that it's the government's mistake and they should have put the court on notice regardless of whether they did it the first time and then made the same error the second time.
But in terms of the standard of review of this, are we to review this for plain error or another standard, since your client knew that this was coming?
Well, I think it is not reviewed for plain error that the error was preserved. The attorney below, I was not a trial counsel, but the attorney below objected when Mr. Brown was being asked about expert witness, expert type questions about the interpretation of words. The base of the objection was foundation, what's the basis for him offering these interpretations. And the district judge clearly understood that to mean, can this guy offer expert testimony? And the district court ruled, yes, he can. Based on his extensive experience in all of these prior investigations, I'm going to let him answer expert questions. The purpose of the contemporaneous objection rule is so that the judge is confronted with the issue, can make a decision on that issue. And we think the judge did make a decision on the issue and that it's the error is preserved for review. I'd just like to highlight the fact that this expert testimony was very key to the case. As I said before, there weren't eyewitnesses. There's videotapes, but the videotapes don't show any drugs or money changing hands. The alleged transactions take place in cars and vans, so nothing is visible on the videotape. The key evidence is the audio tapes, which then are used to interpret it so that they include language about a drug deal. To make matters worse, with the second our second point, both experts went beyond what they should have been testifying about. York understands that this court has allowed experts to testify on the meaning of drug code words and the practices of the drug trade, which may be unfamiliar to the jury. But these witnesses are very powerful witnesses, as this court has recognized. They often shape the jury's understanding of a case. And therefore, the court needs to be vigilant about making sure that they respect the proper bounds of what's expert testimony and then what sets beyond that. Perhaps the most blatant example of this is Mr. Coleman, who testified about the meaning of a phrase, get your money straight. Frankly, I don't see why this needs any expert testimony. The phrase seems self-explanatory to me, common parlance.
Was there any harm?
Yes, I think there was, because in the answer, Mr. Coleman says, get your money straight means get your money together, adding absolutely nothing, but then he adds, get your money together for the 9-ounce purchase. Very prejudicial remark that this was a drug deal, based on the term of get your money together, which is not any
sort
of...
Everybody was talking about, right?
What?
That's what everybody was talking about. Was it any revelation to the jury that the expert said that?
I think it was. I think it was that the expert, once again, is saying, basically allowed to say this is a drug deal. If he wants to interpret words, that's fine. The expert's just there because the jury can't understand some of these words. They may be... they're uncommon, they're outside the realm of the jury. I think these witnesses are very powerful, so when they say something like, get your money together for the drug deal, then the jury may accept, well, it's a drug deal going on, and they'll adopt the expert's interpretation without realizing that it's their job to interpret what these phrases mean. It's not them just to take the experts at their word. I think both experts also testified to the meaning of simple numbers. I don't see why an expert is needed to interpret what the word 9 means, or 6, or 55, or 5. These are numbers. They're on Sesame Street. We all know what the numbers are. We don't need an expert to come and tell us what they mean. The question is what inference to draw. And these are experts in drug code, not experts in drawing inferences from ambiguous conversations. The jury is just as skilled at that skill as the experts are. It doesn't need their prejudicial impact by inferring drug quantities or money quantities from these simple numbers. I would just like to distinguish one case which the government cites, United States versus Briscoe, which in a parenthetical says that this court has recognized that the words 1 and 2 would be proper for expert testimony. That case was actually involved a co-conspirator who testified to the meaning of coded words, and his testimony was let in by the district court and the Court of Appeals under Rule 602, personal knowledge. And we don't dispute that someone, if they actually had personal knowledge of what these terms meant in our case, for example, Tracy Mitchell, could have testified to their meaning, but they're not appropriate for an expert who doesn't have that personal knowledge to then opine on common words. The government's also suggested that, which is true, that the experts can interpret elliptical phrases, which may have more than one meaning. We think these phrases are not elliptical at all. Elliptical phrases are, for example, the recent case of United States versus Moon, there was a phrase, four, five, six meals, which the expert interpreted to mean four or five, six quantities of drugs. Like meals could equal drugs. There's no sort of elliptical phrase here. They're just straight phrases that don't require any expert interpretation, and the jury should just make up their own mind as to what they mean. And the defendant is prejudiced when the well-respected law enforcement officers get up in their uniforms and tell the jury what to think about these things. And thirdly, the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights were violated when the experts testified to what the non-testifying informant meant when he said various phrases. I think this is a blatant Sixth Amendment violation because it's bad enough that, and we recognize that someone, the tape can come in if it is used just for context to understand Mr. York's admissions. But in that case, you can play the tape and the jury can listen to it and they can just use Mr. Mitchell's statements and put them into context and use York and then to understand what Mr. York was saying. However, the government took another step beyond that and went to telling the jury what Mitchell actually meant when he was saying that. York had no opportunity to cross-examine Mitchell on what he meant, and now he's faced with respected law enforcement officers who are telling the jury, this is what Mitchell really meant when he said that. And there's no way to cross-examine that, and you're instead of faced with Mitchell, you're faced with law enforcement officers. I see my running into my rebuttal time, so unless you have questions.
Apparently not. Thank you. We'll hear now from Ms. Littleton.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Gail Littleton, and I represent the United States. The district court in this case did not commit plain error when it permitted Agent Brown, to testify as both a lay witness and an expert. The standard here is clearly plain error based on this record. In order to preserve the error, the defendant must specifically object in a way that alerts the district court to what is at issue. That did not happen here. There are really only four instances where the defendant objected and made a specific objection to the testimony. In each of those instances, the defendant objected to and basically used the phrase basis of knowledge. From this statement, the defendant is objecting to foundation. He's making a foundational objection, and that is clear from the record for several reasons. First, the words basis of knowledge indicate that the objection is based on foundation. Second, the district court's response indicates that the district court believed that the objection was one of foundation when the district court said and responded that the testimony was based on the agent's knowledge and experience. And third, this exact same language, an objection for basis of knowledge, is exactly what the defendant said when he objected to Agent Coleman's testimony when there was no dispute over any dual testimony. Specifically, on page 509 of the record, with regard to Agent Coleman's testimony, the defense objected specifically no basis for testimony. At 514, the defendant objected, saying lack of foundation, no basis of knowledge. Because this is the exact same phrase used when the objection is clearly a foundational objection for Agent Coleman, it's also used with regard to Agent Brown, it becomes even more clear that what he is objecting to at this time is, in fact, foundation as opposed to dual testimony. It is also, from this, there's just, because it is so unclear, there is no reason to believe from this record that the court was alerted in any way that he was making a specific objection to Agent Brown's dual testimony as both an expert and a lay witness here. For that reason, the court must review the issues for plain error. The defendant's substantial rights were not affected by the admission of Agent Brown's testimony for three reasons, because that's what we're looking at now. Were his substantial rights affected? First, Agent Brown possessed the requisite experience and qualifications to testify as an expert. The defense does not contest that. He had 17 years with the FBI, had participated in over a couple of hundred narcotics investigations, seizures of crack cocaines, 50 to 100 controlled purchases. He was clearly a qualified individual. He was not, but the government also recognizes he was not specifically qualified in this instance, but he did possess the requisite qualifications. Second, although the government should have disclosed that he would be testifying as an expert, because of the first trial, the defense did have notice, but that, again, the government concedes that that notice should have been provided. Second, with regard to substantial rights, the Agent Brown testified in areas that this court has deemed over and over are proper for expert testimony. Testimony regarding code words, testimony regarding the practices of drug dealers is clearly the kind of testimony that the rule permits.
But the rule wasn't complied with in terms of identifying him as an expert, providing his credentials and so forth.
That's correct, Judge.
You just blew right by that.
That's right. The government did not disclose him as an expert and did not qualify him as an expert during the testimony. Did not ask that he be qualified during the testimony. And there was expert testimony that was elicited from Agent Brown in addition to the lay testimony. So the government doesn't dispute that.
And the testimony that you concede is expert from Brown. That preceded Coleman's testimony, didn't it?
It did, Judge.
And Coleman's testimony really duplicates Brown's on those points, doesn't it?
It does. It is cumulative in some sense in that regard, that they did testify to some of the same things. But in this case, the issue being, were his substantial rights violated? The main concern that we have, that the court has in this kind of a case, is whether or not the jury is confused or there's undue weight given to the testimony. What happened in this case, I think, demonstrates that neither of those were the case. First of all, the defendant did object to some of the expert testimony. Now, I'll point out that it wasn't until sometime into that testimony that there was any objection at all. And when it did come out, the district court was quick to respond and say that the agent was testifying based on his knowledge and experience. And that negated any concern that somehow the jury would be confused that the agent was testifying based on some sort of special knowledge as to the defendant's criminal background or as to the defendant's mental process.
But what about jumping back and forth between the expert opinions and his factual observations? That makes it difficult for the jury to understand in what capacity he's testifying from minute to minute.
Well, the government's the beginning of the government's questions in with regard to the expert testimony almost always started out with based on your experience as opposed to based on what happened in this case. There were a few instances where the government started with based on your experience as well in other narcotics investigations and as well as this investigation. But because I think because the government sort of distinguished that in the initial part of the question, it was a signal to the judge and to the jury that there had been a shift to more of an more expert testimony. And certainly with the objections and then the court's response to that, it indicated to the jury that this was not, that the answers that were given were not in fact based on what happened in this particular case, but instead based on his knowledge and experience as a law enforcement officer. So again, the jury was not, at least confusion of the jury and the concern for undue weight being placed on testimony was alleviated not only by the district court's response to the question, but the court also told the jury that they were free to accept or reject this testimony. Again, not treating it in any special manner or bolstering it in any way. In addition, the defendant had the opportunity to cross-examine and, in fact, did cross-examine Agent Brown after his testimony. And then finally, the defendant points out that there was no specific cautionary instruction given in the jury instructions. And he is correct in that, but the defendant never asked for such an instruction. The court sort of continued to caution throughout the testimony, but no specific instruction was given, but there was no request either. The pattern instruction was, however, given, which indicated to the jury that they should treat that testimony the same way they would treat as any other witness testimony. With regard to the defense claim regarding Agent Coleman, again, Agent Coleman's testimony was properly admitted, as this court has held numerous times, because he was testifying to code and the practice of drug dealers. They focused particularly on Agent Coleman's testimony regarding the definition of get your money straight or what that meant, and his then follow on to that of for a 9-ounce purchase. The jury is presumed to be unfamiliar with drug trafficking, so it may seem that get your money straight might be have an innocent explanation, and that it certainly it could. It could also have a nefarious explanation, and that's the reason for expert testimony, because when there are alternative explanations, that is one of the reasons why an expert is appropriate in this case. So certainly it could have been, you know, keep your checkbook more accurately, or it could be, you know, get your drug payment together. So for that reason, Agent Coleman's testimony was also proper in this case. And again, there was a jury instruction at the close of the evidence where the expert testimony instruction was given. With regard to the confrontation clause, there was no confrontation clause issue here either, because the confidential informant statements on the recording were not offered for their truth, but simply to provide context for the defendant's own statements. This was a negotiation. There was talk about 6, there was talk about 9, there was talk about 55 and 5. In order for the jury to properly understand what is going on here, the reason why an expert is needed is to explain that to them. And if the expert is only allowed to explain the statements of the defendant, and there are, as the defense points out, ambiguous statements made by the confidential informant, they would be left confused, and there would simply be no need for the expert at that point, because they would be just as confused as when they started. In this case, the Agent Coleman correctly provided that testimony so that he could clear up any confusion related to that negotiation. So those statements were not offered for their truth, but simply for context.
Was the jury instructed that the admission of the informant's side of the conversation was for that limited purpose?
Yes, Judge. They were instructed. And then I'll just make one final point, and that is that that is one of harmless errors. Should this court conclude that the substantial rights were affected, the defendant's substantial rights were affected, any error was harmless. The evidence was overwhelming in this case. The CI was searched before he went in for the first meeting, provided with the money, came back, only had 500 remaining. Same thing happened with the second, had no drugs going in, came back with drugs. So because the evidence was overwhelming in this case, were this court to conclude there was plain error, any error was harmless. And the government would request that this court affirm the judgment below for the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Littleton. How much time does Mr. Keenan have? Thank you.
Just a few quick points. The government seeks to negate the admitted error of introducing Brown by saying that it was cumulative of Coleman. However, I think the cumulative nature of it makes it even worse that first they're introduced to Brown, who has all the first-hand knowledge of the case, and he explains what he thinks all the code words mean. Then they bring in Coleman, who's like the neutral expert who doesn't have any investigation, who backs up Brown, and I think they're mutually reinforcing, and the jury was first exposed to Brown, who had the first-hand knowledge. I think the nefarious explanation of get your money straight is get your money together. If that's a nefarious explanation, then doesn't seem like a nefarious explanation to me. And for the Sixth Amendment, the government was using York's or Mitchell's statements for the truth of the matter asserted. In closing argument, the prosecutor relies on the interpretations of 9-9, probably hard that this is 9 ounces of crack. The experts were both testifying that in the voice of Mitchell, they're saying when Mitchell says this, Mitchell means that. When Mitchell says this, Mitchell means that. Well, I think that's just inappropriate when the prosecution is able to put a law enforcement officer up on the stand to explain what a non-testifying witness really means when his statements are coming in. Those are my rebuttal points. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Apparently not, Mr. Keaton. Thank you. Court, we first of all like to thank Mr. Keenan, who took this case by appointment of the court. Mr. Keenan, you have the deep thanks of the court for your fine work on behalf of your client, and we also thank your law firm for having taken on this case and devoted the resources it did devote to this project. Lastly, the court would like to thank both Mr. Keenan and Ms. Littleton for their very fine presentations today. The case will be taken under advisement.